Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. It is a double guest episode this week. We begin with Bobby Marks, the Vertical Front Office Insider. Bobby and I discuss just how desperate the Toronto Raptors need to be in the pursuit of Hawks forward Paul Millsap.
I think you can become more aggressive now because you've gotten to the conference finals already. It wasn't like you lost there. You know how far this team can get you, and I think that's where they can get you right now is a conference finals.
And later, Trailblazers guard CJ McCollum tells me what's behind the Blazers' early season struggles.
The injuries have hurt us, and then just lack of execution. A lack of efficiency, lack of consistency on both ends of the floor has caused us to lose some games.
All that and more next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. All right, welcome back to another episode, Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Joining me here in the New York studios, the rare appearance, the well-tanned, relaxed Bobby Marks. How's life in Florida, Bobby?
It's a lot better than 20 degrees in New York City. Goodness gracious, I don't miss this coldness right now.
You've been a New York area guy for a long time, so you know this. But this is the time of year, January, February, when you really start to rethink life priorities. Like, as much as you love New York City and love the atmosphere of the Northeast, January and February, when it's bone-chillingly cold, when snow is on the ground, when traffic is at its peak, you start to really wonder what you're doing with yourself.
Well, it's funny. I almost got back on that plane as soon as I stepped off, and I felt that cool breeze coming off the...
From
outside, but there's nothing, you know, there's nothing better than the Northeast, and it does humble you a little bit, so it is good to be back up here.
It's like the day after tomorrow out there as we speak here on a Monday afternoon, but it is early January, which puts us right kind of in the throes of trade season, and we already had a minor but impactful deal with Kyle Korver. We've got a team in Atlanta that could be in the middle of the early stages of a complete teardown. And let's start with Kyle Korver specifically, though, going to the Cavaliers. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of teams in the Eastern Conference, maybe north of the border in Toronto, that aren't all that thrilled that Atlanta just made the conference's best team, the defending champs, what I think is significantly better. I mean, Korver is not having his best three-point shooting year, but you know this, when you put him on a team where he's going to have far more open shots with this group than he did with Atlanta, those numbers are expected to go up. I mean, is there any kind of unwritten rule that says you don't trade a key player or a contributing player to a fellow contender?
No, there isn't. And I think when you're making a trade, you're really looking out for the best interest of your own team. I know where Atlanta is, you know, fourth in the East, and Cleveland is the defending champions. And, I look back, Chris, we made a trade the year that Cleveland cleared cap space for LeBron, and ourselves, Boston and Cleveland made a deal where we got Jarrett Jack and Boston got Marcus Thornton, and they wound up getting a first-round pick in the deal, Tyler Zeller also. That cleared the way for LeBron, and then Boston wound up trading that for Isaiah Thomas. So usually it's not about that trade. It's usually about the next one, where what you can do with those assets, and maybe something Atlanta can do with that, you know, that pick in 2019. We don't know where that Cleveland team will be. You know, you guys get older. I know the nucleus is locked in here, but no, there isn't an unwritten rule. I know they've gotten a little bit of some criticism here, but if you look at it, where are you going to re-sign Korver at the end of this season? Probably not. So you had him for 4 months. You also have to be realistic as far as where you are right now. They're fourth in the East, and they're probably, I still think they're a playoff team. We'll see what happens with Millsap. But you got to look out at the best interest of your own club.
No, I agree. Mike Budenholzer, Wes Wilcox, they're not out to help the Toronto fans. They're not out to help the Celtics organization. They're looking out for themselves and to be able to get a first round pick. And, you know, this is going to be a first round pick. I mean, it's, you know, Cleveland's not going to be so bad that the top 10 protections in 19 and what 20 are going to turn that pick into 2 second rounders. It's not going to happen. They'll get a mid first round pick out of this particular deal. And that's a good haul for Kyle Korver, who is probably going to be gone at the end of the year. I mean, I think it's great foresight by the Hawks to recognize that, yeah, they're a good team. They might even be a second round team. Things break right, they could be a conference finals team, but they have no shot against the Cavaliers in the postseason. So to pull the trigger on this now and get a first round pick for an expiring contract, I think that's an A move for the Cavaliers.
Well, I think it's a win-win for both.
And for Atlanta, I should say.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a win-win for Cleveland and Atlanta. And I look at with how Cleveland has you know, last year with the trade that, you know, they moved Varejao to get Fry eventually, and they moved the first round pick to Portland, which eventually became a first round pick this year. And you can do that with picks. You can trade future first round picks because you've got LeBron and Kyrie and Kevin Love, J.R. Smith. That group is locked in, man, for the next 3 or 4 years. And if they were going into a year where potentially those players were free agents and on expiring contracts, then I'd say, well, wait a minute, you know, hold back on what, because you don't know if you're going to be able to resign. But when you have that kind of luxury, a safety net, as I say, you can go out and do that.
Now, the next domino is expected to be Paul Millsap at some point, also a free agent to be. He's going to be 32 next month, a very good player, a versatile player, but I'm just guessing that it's not someone Atlanta wants to commit $100 million plus dollars to over a long-term deal. They can look around. They can be judicious. You've got about a month to go. But a team like Toronto, which is in kind of an arms race right now with the Cavaliers, which is not in the same position the, say, the Bucks or even the Celtics are in as teams that can afford to kind of wait Cleveland out. I mean, how aggressive do the Raptors have to be in trying to extract Paul Millsap?
Well, it's going to be interesting. You have got two different ways you can go about it. You can go about it last year how we saw them, and the picks they had last year were probably better because they had that you know, that Nick or Denver pick, you know, the worst of the two, and you had a team that was, you know, you had a real good, similar to now, a really good team. Now you've got, you do have two first round picks because you've got your own, you've got the Clippers, you've got your own future, and you've got a lineup that's locked up. You know, Lowry would be a free agent. So I think you can become more aggressive now because you've gotten to the conference finals already. It wasn't like you lost there. You know how far this team can get you, and I think that's where they can get you right now is a conference finals, because I don't see them beating Cleveland, come May and June here. So is it a Terrence Ross?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
What do you have to give up? What kind of player do you have to get him? Now, I don't think it's, some people have speculated that, you know, that the Hawks will try to gouge you for, you know, like for a team like Boston, they'd want one of the Brooklyn picks. I don't think they're going to reach that high. They know that an expiring contract for a soon to be 32-year-old, it's not the same as a different type of player. But, you know, Terrence Ross, you know, probably on that list. I mean, how deep do you go into the reserves, into the young talent, to get a Paul Millsap?
Well, I wouldn't do anything with, you know, Norman Powell, but just because I think if you do something with Ross, then he's your guy kind of waiting in the wings here. Patrick Patterson's going to be a free agent at the end of the season. How much are you going to have to pay him? 10, 12 million, maybe even more. You know, those are two guys that potentially could fit. As I said, you do have your draft pick. So I think when we get closer to the 23rd of February, I think Atlanta, based on where they are record-wise, if they have an indication on what Millsap, and I think they probably do have an indication of what Millsap is probably going to cost you next year, would probably look to do something instead of, you know, like the Horford. And I don't blame them last year for not moving Horford, you know, to give that group another go at it.
Yeah, they wanted, you know, a high price for those guys, and deservedly so. They were under contract, and they were a talented group. But now, you know, Millsap, I'd be more aggressive with Millsap. Now, doing what you're doing right now, and Dwight Howard really isn't in the conversation yet. But doing what they're doing, I think you try to move Millsap as soon as possible with the right deal. But what do you think of Millsap? I mean, is he a difference maker? You put Paul Millsap on the Toronto Raptors, and he becomes, you know, basically your starting power forward there alongside the guys they already have. I mean, how close does that get them to Cleveland?
It gets them closer. He's going to be 32 in February. He's been durable. I think he missed maybe one or two games last year. The number is going to be, that's the one thing you're going to have to swallow. When, you know, we've talked about expiring contracts. When, depending on how much you give up for that, I think that really dictates as far as what your salary is. If you give up a future first and some fillers or some expirings, then your feet aren't over the fire when you have to re-sign that player for a lot. But if you're giving up some core pieces and some future picks, I think where you are cap-wise, I don't see them being a player from a free agent standpoint just because of the Lowry free agency. So that would be basically your free agent. And the only downside is that I call it the Batum effect, where, you know, how Charlotte got Batum in that trade for Portland in June. So you had the whole year to basically sell him on the organization, on a team. So now you have, you know, with Millsap, you have him, you know, basically for 4 months to sell him on that. But the benefit is you've got Damari Carroll there, player he's already played with. That's a first-class city, coaching, management, all across the board. And they've, you know, they've been on a national stage the last couple of years here.
Yeah, and you can't start nickel and diming if you're Toronto. If it's a matter of being a tax-paying team and spending a bunch of money, you've got to do it. Now, otherwise, you have to accept that the future of your team is at the conference finals tops. Because even when Cleveland runs out of gas, Lowry will be an older player and probably not what he is right now. And Boston's going to be right behind you. I mean, Boston is not a contender in the sense of Toronto right now, but a couple of years from now, after Danny Ainge makes a trade to free up that logjam in the backcourt, develops another couple of first-round picks or the assets that he gets in return from them, Toronto's in that I think it's a three-year window right now for the Toronto Raptors. They've got to find a way to get past Cleveland these next 3 years, or they're going to be looking at a rebuild of their own.
Well, and it's also interesting to see how they evaluate their young players, their former first round picks that they've drafted, and how do they fit into the future? Because if they don't, then they're more expendable. If they were kind of rank guys, if they were, a key reserve, then maybe you do hold on to them because that could be your next line of players. But Bruno, DeLon Wright has been hurt. Those are your guy. Pascal Siakam has started. Poeltl has come off the bench. So how do you evaluate those young players? Because if you don't feel like they're ready to take that next step, and I don't know if they are besides Siakam who started, then I think you certainly have to be more aggressive here.
All right, let's talk about the Pelicans, a team that you flew thousands of miles to come up and see. They're in the middle of Pelicans week here in New York. Two games. They got the Knicks and the Brooklyn Nets this week, kind of an East Coast swing for New Orleans. They're not good once again, but Bobby, they're not good in a surprising way. They're actually defending at a reasonable level, and an Alvin Gentry coach team can't score the basketball. Like, they're bottom five right now in the NBA in offensive efficiency, field goal percentage. I mean, they're bad. Why are they so bad? What I can understand if an Alvin Gentry coach team isn't defending at the highest of levels. I don't understand how they're not scoring at a high level.
Well, it was almost fool's gold a little bit when they put Davis at the center position. They changed that lineup. They're six games in with that lineup. They're 3-3 where you went Holiday, Hield, Hill, Cunningham, Davis. In your first three, you started off great. I think you're averaging about 105 points a game against New York, Dallas, the Clippers. You got the Clippers on a time when they were on a losing streak. The three losses, Atlanta, Boston, Cleveland. Good, solid defensive teams here. So you look at that lineup, the outside of Anthony Davis, and their bench actually has been pretty good here. It's like putting names in a hat and picking out who's going to be that second fiddle every night. And you don't have another reliable threat on an offensive standpoint. Yeah, can a guy like Buddy Hield get you 20 a night? Yeah, he can. But is it going to happen one every four games, one every five games? You just don't have that consistency there.
Yeah, and when I ask around about the Pelicans and why they're struggling, invariably the responses I get are personnel. And what they have there. And you're right. I mean, you look at the lineups they're starting now when they go small, it's what, Dante Cunningham at one spot alongside Anthony Davis. Solomon Hill is starting on the other slot alongside Davis. These are not offensive-oriented players. These are not guys that can, they don't strike fear in anybody. And basically, as you put it, you're basically hoping that Buddy Hield goes off and has, a 20 to 30-point night, or else there's a good chance Anthony Davis is kind of alone on an island, and they're not that good defensively that they can get away with that every single night. It's something they don't want to talk about over there, but I bet they wish that Ryan Anderson and Eric Gordon were playing the way they're playing in Houston right now, because Gordon was lost for them with injuries most of last year. Anderson missed a huge chunk of time. I mean, those guys in Houston, ironically playing for Mike D'Antoni, Alvin Gentry, worked with Alvin extensively. If those guys were playing that way in New Orleans, they might be onto something there. But now it's the Cunninghams and the Hills, and and cross your fingers if Tyreek Evans does anything. There's just so many question marks personnel-wise with this team.
Well, they have a lot of players that teams would like to have, but coming off your bench.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's in all honesty there. And, you know, we've talked about Solomon Hill at length, the contract there. You've got Evans back, not where he was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Drew Holiday, you know, the rookies played pretty well. I'll give him that. And they've got nice, I like some of their bench players. I like the Langston Galloways, the Etuan Moores, those type players, but not for a starter for me. But they're in that mix though, Chris. They're in that eight seed is like nobody wants it. Nobody wants it at all.
The Timberwolves and Mavericks are like 4 or 5 games back right now. They can still wake up today and say, if we put a good week together, we're right there.
You know, you're right. It's I think the Lakers are 2 behind. You know, I thought Portland would take a stranglehold a little bit. They lose in Detroit on a home against Detroit on Sunday night. You know, Denver hasn't played great lately. Who knows what Sacramento? I can't trust that team right now for where they are. So that's why, Chris, when we're talking about trades, all right, who's going to be one of these teams here? And I don't think it's Denver because I know Tim has got the patience level with his picks and cap space. But who's going to be the team that's going to trade a first round pick to get into the playoffs? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like I want to, you know, start a pool here because I know it means a lot for Sacramento to get in the playoffs. But you know, they don't have picks unless you want to do something with this year with that that swap with Philly, and then you got to really get creative.
I don't think Sacramento wants to make it. I think with Sacramento, management is far more interested in making a deal than ownership is. That's my sense of the Kings situation right now. I think ownership is still tied at the hip to this concept of making the postseason this year and basically opening this new arena with a three game annihilation at the hands of the Golden State Warriors. I mean, is that just normal for owners to think like that? I mean, because I think management would make a deal. I honestly think management would get, now, I'm not saying they would do it, but they would get aggressive on DeMarcus Cousins tomorrow if they knew they had ownership's backing to move him.
No, and that's the downfall of opening up a new arena. It's almost like the perfect storm in a negative way where you've got this, you know, this franchise player and Cousins. I guess we can call him a franchise player. Player for the Kings,
yeah.
You know.
But you take the personality sure. stuff out, oh, yeah. He's a franchise player.
No, he is. But then you've got the building and you haven't made the playoffs in, I don't know, 11, 12 years here. And now you're sitting a game out of eight. And you know you've got that taste to get into that, and it will be a 4-0 sweep against Golden State. And do you kind of hold your ground and hopefully you get in, and or you do you risk some future assets just to kind of get a taste of that playoffs there? That's going to be pretty interesting to watch, because then you also have Rudy Gay too, as far as what you can do there. Do you feel like you can get into the playoffs without him? They played pretty decent when he was hurt. It's interesting though. But Chris, when I'm telling you, and I've been on the management side of it, and it's a lot different than in the off season when you're not playing. But when you're in the thick of it and you think you have a chance to get into playoffs, even if it's not unrealistic, you do some crazy things, you know, as far as trading things, and then you wake up 4 months from now and you're like, what did you just do here? And I think that's, you know, hopefully for some of these teams, that's what they don't do here.
All right, Bobby, hang on for 1 second for me, because I have to tell my listeners about Blue Apron. Now, you know me, I don't cook very much, but when I do, Blue Apron is the way to go. It is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Its mission, to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. It can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. That's right. You can probably get right down to your front door in Florida. And it is a terrific blend of recipes. It's affordable, less than $10 per person per meal. There's a great variety, flexible delivery patterns, easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free. That's free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Mannix. You will love how good it feels, how good it tastes, to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Mannix, blueapron.com/Mannix. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
I want to ask you about something I wrote about last week, which was, you know, sort of a plan I get kind of emanating out of Oklahoma City about how they get this team back into true contention. That's this belief that in 2 or 3 years there will be a dispersal of stars because of the way basically the CBA will kick in effectively in the next couple of years, and you just won't have teams having stars cluster. And the way that happens is in part due to the fact that some of the max contracts signed a couple of years ago, they're going to expire, and new max contracts, which will gobble up far more cap space, are going to take hold. Do you think that we're, 4 years from now, we're headed towards a day where we're back to maybe at most the two superstar formula, in some cases, one and a well-rounded team to be successful?
No, you're right. And the new CBA, which takes place, it starts in July, I don't think we'll see the impact until about 2 or 3 years from now, because where these rookie contracts, I mean, you're going to have a number one pick in his third or fourth year making $12, $13 million on his rookie contract. And where you'll see some of the changes really have an impact here. And I hate using the example of the housing market but I just think it is. And I think that's where we saw a lot of these teams go crazy this summer. It was like they were almost buying up property, and then all of a sudden the property has no value anymore. Mm-hmm. As far as some of these big contracts. I mean, we can look at Luol Deng in Los Angeles. I mean, what is his value going to be? And I know he's good there for the young kids, Yan Mahinmi in Washington. You know, some of those big Noah in New York. No amnesty. There's no amnesty provision in this new CBA here. So the path that
there should be a rule though that like you can't use an amnesty provision of a guy you just signed. Like you can't take a flyer on that, or you can't cut a guy months after you sign him just because you can. Don't sign him in the first place. That's your punishment.
We did. Yeah. We did it with Travis Outlaw, and he was signed for, I don't even know, 4 years, $35 million, and he got amnestied the next year, and thank God Sacramento claimed him. So it all worked out.
Thank you, Kings.
But I think with how you look at it with Oklahoma City is that they have invested heavily in their young players that they've either acquired in the trade or their draft picks with outside of Westbrook, because he's at a different level right now. But Adams, Oladipo, Cantor, you saw Grant, Sabonis. These are their, we've talked about it at length. They don't go out in free agency and spend money. So this is the direction they've gone the last couple of years here, where this is how they feel they can build a team. And it will be interesting in 2 or 3 years from now where, are they suddenly kind of changed the course a little bit and now become a free agent player, because from a default standpoint, because these players that teams can't afford anymore are going to be out there. So that will be interesting. It's like almost like they're holding, kind of just keeping their head above water, but they can do it. I mean, because how Westbrook has played and let these younger players develop and stuff. But you're right. You know, the CBA is going to be fascinating to watch, over the next couple of years, because I think a lot of teams from what they did under the old CBA is really going to come back and bite them a little bit here.
One of the things that you wrote about this past week was Milwaukee and the impact that Jason Kidd has had on the Bucks. It's funny, you know this as well as anyone, because you were part of the organization in Brooklyn when Jason started coaching there. And from the outside, it didn't look like Jason was long for coaching. It looked like he wanted, it was well reported he made the power play on Billy King out in Brooklyn. And then there were all these mixed reports about whether he was going to go after the presidentship or some sort of general manager position with Milwaukee. Now he's just the head coach out there, albeit one probably with some significant influence. But you think he's done he's evolved into a good coach here. I mean, how would you rate the job Jason has done with this young Milwaukee team?
Well, I look at it and, when he took over in Brooklyn in 2013, he just got done playing. I mean, it was like 2 months removed. I think they had lost straight in the playoffs to Indiana, and then that was it. And then the team he inherited, is it was a veteran-laden, win now And that's...
I wrote the cover story for Sports Illustrated. Yeah. Who wants a piece of us? Turns out everybody did.
Yeah. And for a guy who had never coached before to kind of hand them that. And then, you know, we had the incident with the situation with Lawrence Frank, and he wasn't there anymore. And so when I look at Jason in Brooklyn, I look at what he did after January 1st, how he was able to really kind of keep that team together. You had Brooke broke his foot in December. Darren was injured, and how we kind of managed the bench and Pierce and Garnett and kind of gave them a second life. And you know, we ran off a bunch of games and got into the second round there. And so when I look at him from that, I don't look at when he took over in November, December, how he kind of evolved from there, and then where he went to Milwaukee and had that good first year there. You know, they kind of took a backseat a little bit last year. Now we're here, we are in year three, and how he's able to kind of just take what they have, Middleton injury, dealing with adversity, Giannis taking another step, Jabari Parker back from the ACL. And I think he's done a heck of a job here. It's not easy going to a place and putting that team on the map. A small market city, they've got a new arena coming in, a practice facility. There's a lot of good things there. So I think he's done, and I still think he's learning. I think you can always still learn, but he played under Rick Carlisle, you know, one of the best. So, and I think he's taken on some of that from what he learned in Dallas.
What is Giannis 3 years from now?
Oh man, I look at his body where it is right now, Chris, and where it was, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And it will be interesting when Middleton comes back. But I think, and I don't like using franchise players until they've done
right.
Something. LeBron, Kawhi Leonard.
Giannis hasn't been an all-star yet.
You know, so. But he has all the potential to be on that level. And he's got the potential. He's like, we talked about the Porzingis effect. You know, does Porzingis have the effect to draw free agents to New York? You know, if that's the case. And I think Giannis does in Milwaukee. And I know from a city standpoint, it's probably not the appeal as a LA or Miami or New York. But I think guys will want to play with, they got to get into the playoffs. That's important to get on that stage. But guys will want to come play with him.
Yeah. I think the core is well tended there. And one thing it's gotta be nice if you're John Hammond and Justin Zanuck and the brass in Milwaukee to have some clarity. Like, you know who you are. Like, you're in the playoff mix right now. I mean, they'll probably make it, because I think they'll surge more towards the end of the season than maybe Chicago or Washington potentially will. But you don't have any expectation the next 2 years. Your expectations are to grow and develop. Then you're talking year three, 2019, when your guys are all in their mid-20s. That's when you can expect maybe a decline from Cleveland, when LeBron is in his mid, almost late 30s. That's when Toronto might slow down a little bit. You have to be targeting that, you know, 19, 20, 21 season is when you make your move. And that's got to be a great feeling for an executive to see that path and see, some leeway to get better.
Well, and the worst feeling is that when you're forced to make a trade.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's usually when the one-sided trades happen, because you're really thinking about the now and not the future, and they're not in that position to do so. And you're right about Cleveland. I think for some of these teams, it's almost like waiting them out till, you know, LeBron gets older and maybe there's some chinks in the armor eventually. We don't see it now, but with and Love and
well, maybe they stop being able to afford guys. I mean, you heard LeBron, he's out there declaring, go get a backup point guard. I mean, he's taking it to the media, but you know, they had one in Dellavedova, but they couldn't afford him. And this is what we're talking about with the CBA. I mean, as that cap starts to, you know, we're already seeing it, you know, not go as high as the projections are expected to be. These guys, those bench guys, you'll still be able to have the Thompsons and the Loves and the Irvings and LeBron, but it's going to be the Kay Felders of the world, so to speak, with that group. And that's going to pose problems for Cleveland.
No, you're right. And with Dellavedova, he was restricted. So you had the right to match, or you had to, you know, if you, you know, but that would have cost you, that would have cost you a lot of money. Then you had to, go out and sign, you know, would that have meant you losing J.R. Smith? So there's a domino effect, and that's going to be your case. Cleveland now is going to be where Golden State is going to be in three, you know, probably 2 or 3 years, when Thompson or Green are free agents, because Can you afford all four? Yeah, you can afford them, but it's probably going to cost you $160 million. And then you don't have any draft picks because you've traded them, or, you know, some of the, we don't know that what the jury is out on some of these guys they've drafted in before. And now you're relying on minimums and those, you know, your mid or your tax exception to build your bench out. And that's the problem. It's a good problem to have when you have franchise level players. But the downside is that, you know, what your resources are really limited here.
We started talking about trades. I want to wrap it up with a little bit of trade chatter as well. Something we addressed in our video stuff last week, and that's Rajon Rondo still out of the rotation in Chicago. No indications at all if or when he's going to get back into that rotation as we enter sort of the last month or so before the trade deadline. Is there a market for this guy? I mean, is there anything the Bulls can do to try to recoup something in return? Or if you're them, do you hold on to him and see what happens?
I would hold on to him right now. If anything, if there'll be a market if there's a buyout March 1st, I think there'll be teams, you know, playoff level teams out there would take a risk on him. But just from a salary standpoint, I don't see where the market is unless you're going to just do expiring contracts and make a trade to do a trade. I don't think Chicago would ever risk, you know, putting a pick or, you know, their own or that Sacramento pick with him just to get rid of him. I wouldn't see that. I think you just kind of, if you're going to get rid of him, you do it, you know, right before the March 1st deadline.
Yeah. And as you've mentioned in the video stuff before, and it's out there, obviously the $3 million he's only owed next year. So you would never attach anything to it, right? You just, if somebody wants to take him and give you, you know, second round pick back in return, I don't know, some kind of minimal asset. Maybe if you're convinced that he's not going to help you, then you make that move. But I wouldn't attach anything real to it.
No, because it's basically an expiring contract. If there was, if he had signed a 2-year, $28 million contract, and next year was guaranteed for 13, then, and you really needed to get rid of him, then yeah, that's what you have to do. You have to attach something of appeal for a team to take on his salary.
Along those the point guard lines too, I wanted to ask you about John Wall in Washington, seventh in the guard voting in the All-Stars in the Eastern Conference, something he took notice of and has taken to Twitter. And
I hope he doesn't take notice of his podcast, because you're going to probably ask me. He's probably not going to be happy with.
Well, I mean, you know, he's having his best statistical season. He's scoring in the fourth quarter. I think he's top 10 in scoring in the fourth quarter. Is he a franchise player? Is he the kind of guy, is he being dissed by the fans here, or are there bigger flaws in John Wall's game than people don't know about?
Well, I think it depends on what your criteria for a franchise player is. I think that's when it comes down to it. And I don't think it has to be making all NBA or making the All-Star game. And for me, there's only a handful for me who are franchise guys. And I look at franchise players. If I'm a general manager and I have a franchise player, if I have a Harden or Westbrook, Durant, LeBron, one of those type of, and I get a call from a team, the what I want to hear from that general manager is, I will trade anybody on my roster, including draft picks you pick. That's what I want to hear, you know, and that's how I kind of deem franchise level, basically say, pick whatever you want. Mm-hmm. I think Anthony Davis, you can put into that equation. Some of the younger kids, you can eventually put that into that equation. But I think with Wall, he's a very good player, Chris. I mean, is he a franchise? I don't think so. I think he's a core piece of that Washington team. Him and Bradley Beal are. But it's funny because, like, is Kyrie Irving a franchise player? I mean, is he a franchise player now because LeBron's here? But he wasn't a franchise player back in 2010 or when, you know, or 11 when he was drafted, and he, you know, that team was not very good. So, you know, for me, he isn't, but my parameters are very tough, you know, to get into that group, and there's only like five or six right now.
I think I agree with you that there's a handful of guys you would deem franchise players. LeBron is one. Anthony Davis is certainly another. Wall is getting tagged with the futility of the franchise. Only been to the playoffs twice in his career, lost both in the conference semifinals. But I don't know that that's, some of that is on him because, as you know, as a leader of a team and as a quote franchise type player, you've got to push your team over the top in certain situations, get them into the playoffs in certain situations. But I trace Washington's issues to 2011 and that 2011 draft. and how things went completely wrong for them. They drafted two guys in that first round. It was Jan Vesely who went first ahead of Klay Thompson and Kawhi Leonard. And then later in the teens, they draft Chris Singleton over Tobias Harris, Kenneth Faried, and Jimmy Butler. Could you imagine how different the Wizards' fortunes are right now if they hit on that draft instead of missing with both guys?
And that's the draft. I mean, that's how, you know, it's a crapshoot. You think you have the right, and I saw when Vesely came out, he did a workout. He didn't work out with any teams, but he did a workout in our facility, and all the NBA teams came up, you know, like 3 days before the draft, and you know, put on a pretty good show. And I don't know if that sold Washington on him at the time, but yeah, I mean, that's when you look back and you have 50-50 vision here. That's the downfall of it. And now when you miss out on the draft, then you're relying on free agency. And then you're relying on Jan Mahimi and Andrew Nicholson and Jason Smith. And hopefully, you know, you've gotten good development from Otto Porter, you know? So, and that team is, that team
Otto
is,
Porter might be a max guy.
He might
summer.
Be. Yeah. Because it's not a great crop of, you know, some of the threes. And
I think he will be, because the teams that have cap space are the bad teams this summer. You're looking at Sacramento and even New York, Brooklyn of course,
Philadelphia. Yeah.
And they might, especially Brooklyn and Philadelphia, do you think Brooklyn and the Sixers would, well, the Sixers maybe if they got Ben Simmons at three, but I think the Nets would blink at giving Otto Porter that type of money. I mean, they threw Alan Crabb 90 or whatever it was, $70 million. They threw Tyler Johnson $50 million. I don't think they'd blink at giving Otto Porter a max deal.
No, you're right. And what Washington, that their free agency for 2017 was last year. I mean, that's where you're going to see a lot of these teams that spent in 2016 are now hamstrung from a financial end, basically stuck with this team. And Washington is one of them. You know, it's what you see right now is what you get next year, barring a trade.
Well, Bobby, enjoy Pelicans Week in New York. That's a big reason why you came north instead of going west to see the Pelicans in person for a couple of times this week.
Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports the Vertical Podcast. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/audible. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
If you're enjoying this program, then check out the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
What's the one thing that you take away from Bill Belichick and you say, this is the thing that everybody else is missing?
Everything is about supplying information to Bill so he can make the decisions. And Bill has the front office and the coaching staff all on the same page. That's the biggest difference. And there's never a day off with Bill Belichick.
Listen and subscribe to new episodes every Wednesday of the MMQB podcast with Peter King.
Well, CJ McCollum is the reigning most improved player, and he's having an even better statistical season this year, averaging more than 20 points per game for the Portland Trail Blazers. I'm sure CJ, though, would trade that those numbers for a better record with the team this year. And CJ joins me here on the podcast. CJ, let's just jump right into it, man. You know, you guys have been talked about a lot coming into the season as, you know, that next tier contender, and obviously it hasn't gotten off to the start that you'd like. I mean, just explain to me from what you see about why this season hasn't gone the way you guys probably hoped it would start.
I think it's a combination of things, honestly. Obviously, when you go through a season, it's always important to stay healthy. I think we've had some injuries. Chief Alfred Gomino got hurt early on in the season and caused him to miss 18, 19 games. And he's our best defender by far. He's able to guard a lot of different positions. And I think towards the end of the year, you know, playing him at the four and starting Mo Harkless is one of the reasons why we became a better team. So with him getting hurt, that's kind of put us in some different positions and different situations that we weren't accustomed to. And then obviously Dame's coming off the ankle sprain. You know, he just played last night. So I think the injuries have hurt us, and then just lack of execution. a lack of efficiency, lack of consistency on both ends of the floor has caused it to lose some games, you know, at the end of games, you know, against sub 500 teams or teams who are barely over 500. And that's led to a lot of losing streaks.
Yeah, just elaborate for me, CJ, on the Aminu absence. I wrote about this, you know, back in, I think it was early December, because I just don't think people really recognized or gave enough credit to the idea that this guy was so important to what you do. I mean, people say, well, you're a star-studded team with you and Lillard, but I mean, Aminu was with his individual defense, his team defense. I mean, he's been critically important to your success the last couple of years.
Yeah, Aminu is a great player. His ability to guard multiple positions, he's a veteran guy, one that we're comfortable with, one that we know we can count on him each night. We know exactly what he's going to do. I think when he went out, it caused us to, obviously, you got to play different lineups. You got to, you know, coach is trying to figure out who he should put in there. And the chemistry and the cohesiveness isn't always there when a starter goes out. I think you see the Clippers kind of going through that now. Obviously, the magnitude of the injury is a little bit higher with Blake being out and CP being out at the same time. I think JJ might have missed a game or two, but mm-hmm. You see it all across the league. When a player goes out, it changes the team dynamic. Draymond Green missing a game for the Golden State Warriors. It changes the team dynamic. It changes everything. And obviously, it's still important that you figure it out and win games, but people don't understand that it's all about all the parts. You know, everybody collectively helping the team, not just you know, one or two players. And I think that we need everybody in order for us to be as good as we would like to be.
He's back now, and he's giving you, you know, the 35, 36 minutes per night that you're hoping to get. I mean, have you seen a difference in this team defensively with him back? And has he helped since he's come back over the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think our defensive rating is night and day with him out there. Mm-hmm. You know, with him out there, we're a top 15 defensive efficiency team. And without him, we struggled a lot. We gave up a lot of points. Our offense wasn't the same. And I think it showed. It showed, you know, the last, I think, six, seven games where we're top five in the NBA defensive rating. And that's including games against the Spurs and the Raptors, who are some of the better offensive teams in the NBA. I think the Raptors may have been first in offensive efficiency and being able to score behind the Warriors, obviously. So first in the East Coast. So we got a long ways to go collectively as a unit to continue to get better and figure it out. But now that everybody is healthy, we except for Festus, obviously, we got to figure it out and win games.
You're a leader in that locker room, CJ. And I'm curious, when you have the type of season that you had last year where you exceeded expectations, came into this year, you signed an Evan Turner, you know, people think you're going to be in the mix for that 3-4-5 type of seed. Did you feel like you guys had the same edge coming into this year? It's not necessarily a criticism, but you obviously had the edge last year trying to prove everybody wrong. Do you feel like you came into this season with that same edge?
Yeah, I think from an individual standpoint, definitely. And I think, you know, when guys, you know, secure deals and get contracts and things like that, people use that. When you lose, they try to pick you apart. They figure out ways to say, well, they got paid all this money and they got comfortable or they don't care anymore. And they say things like that, but it's just not true. Obviously, in some cases, that's happened to teams and it's happened to players. But for our guys, everyone's still young. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest thing guys were trying to do now is trying to prove they were worth that. And you look at guys like Alec Crabb, who's having another career year. He's playing well. He's shooting well from the field, and he's 42% from three-point land, making contested and uncontested shots. Evan Turner's efficiency is great. He's playing a similar role that he did in Boston, being one of the primary ball handlers, coming off the bench and guarding a variety of positions. And you look at the way each of us are playing, it's not like we're playing poorly. We're playing well. We just have to defend better as a whole. We got to execute better down the stretch. And I think, you know, coming into this season, we understood that, you know, teams knew exactly how we were going to run certain sets. They know our thumb. They know our motion. And we weren't going to surprise anyone this year. And we knew that coming into the season. So it's just about, you know, figuring out ways to win close games, figuring out ways to put teams away when you get up, and figuring out ways to sustain a level of intensity for four quarters. That's what the good teams do.
Have you felt that inside that locker room, guys have been at sometimes trying too hard to live up to those contracts? You mentioned the Crab and Evan, and obviously you got your own in this past offseason. Is that I mean, is there anything to the idea that, that maybe you're trying to prove too much, guys are trying to prove too much that they're worth these types of deals?
I think early in the season, guys might have felt pressured to perform at a higher level. And I think as the season progressed, I think guys just figured that, you know, they put the time in, they put the work in, just be yourself and try to execute the game plan. So, I mean, that could have been a factor, but I'm not going to make excuses for why we're not winning games. We just weren't winning games. We were losing games we should have won. We had a couple road trips to where we could have went 4-1 or we could have went, you know, 3-2 and end up losing, you know, all the games in the road trip. And that kind of snowballed. And once you get into that phase where you're losing games, then it's easier for the media to write stories about you. It's easier for teams to say that they don't get along, they don't like each other, and they start figuring out different ways to pick your team apart.
Has there been something that's been written or said about you guys in the last month that you've taken significant offense to and you've completely disagreed with?
I mean, I think just from different people, you know, talking about our team that aren't involved with our team, that have nothing to do with our team, haven't, you know, been around us, don't know the players. It's one thing to say they're not losing games or they're not winning games. Mm-hmm. That's okay. You can say that. That's a fact. But to talk about our character, to say that we're not working hard, when you're not even around the team, you don't know how many hours guys are putting in, how much film, how much preparation the staff goes through on a day-to-day basis. That's the stuff that pisses me off, just because you're not there, you know. And to see people talk about leadership, to say that, oh, this guy is doing too many things off the court, when in reality he's still more efficient, you know, playing at an even more elite level, and to critique that is just, it's just unfair and it's unnecessary.
I'm a big fan of Evan Turner. I covered him in Boston a lot last year, and it felt like last year, CJ, he finally got away from being Evan Turner number two pick, trying to live up to that hype with Philadelphia, and became kind of what he is. Evan Turner, a very good kind of utility player, role player, ball handler, what he did there. He's been kind of a work in progress with you guys in Portland this year. How would you evaluate what you've seen from Evan on the floor?
I think he's gotten a lot more comfortable over the course of the season. Early on, obviously, he's trying to figure out the sets, trying to figure out where he can get his opportunities and when to be aggressive and when to make plays for others. But, you know, I'd say the last 20 games, you know, he's looked good. He's been efficient. He's making those pull-up jumpers. He's able to assist guys. And his ability to guard multiple positions definitely helps us. So I think he's played well. And it's unfair when you lose him, everybody gets a part of the blame. You know, they blame the rotation. They blame, you know, the starters. They blame bench players. We all are involved, and we all get, you know, some of the criticism, but I think he's played well, and it's not his fault that we've been losing games.
Yeah, he's the kind of guy that I feel like he's best when he does have the ball in his hands. Like, that's his role with the second unit in Boston last year. That was a breakout role for him, I thought. I mean, he had the ball in his hands. He did all the things you're talking about, the pull-up jumpers, you know, making plays off the dribble, really controlling that second unit. Have you seen more of that, I guess, in the last, you know, two, three weeks?
Yeah, he's definitely got more comfortable, you know, being a primary ball handler, because we have so many plays and people don't understand how important it is to, you know, when you're a primary ball handler, that means you've got to know 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You got to know every position to be able to get guys in those positions, be able to, you know, play on the ball and off the ball. And I think, you know, after going through some games, he's able to call sets now where he can get himself going, call sets where he can get Dame going, myself, and it'd be effortless and not have to think about it. And I think, you know, even last night, I think he had 20-plus points. He had a lot of pull-ups. He was able to get to the free throw line some and distribute the ball well. It's just about comfort at this point, because he can already play basketball.
You mentioned that when you're losing, there are a lot of outside commentary, people speculating on what's going wrong, what's happening inside that locker room. But you tell me, I mean, inside the locker room, how has it been in terms of staying together, in terms of kind of trying to get through this as a group without having friction develop?
Well, we got a tight knit group and a lot of young guys who are on the same career trajectory. So we all get along well. Everybody still hangs out together. There's no animosity in the locker room. There's no hate, no jealousy. Everybody just works hard. So when we see that stuff, it's baffling, because it's like, and we're living the same way we were last year. You know, guys are still doing the same stuff. They're still working hard. They're still trying to figure things out. It's tough when you lose games and there's high expectations and you're not performing the way you'd like to. But, you know, at some point, it has to change and your work ethic has to change and the results will change.
How much do you and Damian talk about, you know, just whether it's on the road or after practice or just in private conversations, how you two can dig this team out of this hole? How much do you guys put it on your shoulders as the stars, as the leaders, to pull this team out of it?
I mean, it's something that's a constant project, you know, just sending each other different articles, sending each other, you know, video, watching video as a whole, you know, with Dame and I and Coach Vanderpool, Dame and I and John Yim, our video coordinator, just watching film and getting things broken down so that we can figure out ways to be more efficient with the play calling, ways to you know, get the ball up across the timeline earlier so that we can get into our offense faster, you know, ways for us to get stops so that we can play and flow and not have to call plays all the time. We're just figuring out, you know, pick and roll defense, off ball defense in ways that we can, you know, impact the game so that we can take on the responsibility of the ups and downs.
Is there an example of that, CJ, whether it's a set or some type of play that you've looked at over the last month or so, you've addressed and you feel like you've fixed and it's better moving forward?
Yeah, I think, you know, our fourth quarter play is something that we've talked a lot about, you know, being able to, you know, run sets in the ball screens as opposed to just, you know, running fist up or diagonal fist to where there's no movement into the ball screen. Just kind of figuring out ways to, you know, put Dame in positions to where he can be aggressive, you know, where he can, you know, kind of similar to Steph Curry, you watch them, the Warriors play, and sometimes Kevin Durant's the primary ball handler in games, and that free step up to come off triples, come off pin downs, flares, and the same goes for Kevin Durant, you know, putting those two in ball screens. So just watching film on other teams, you know, Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, figuring out ways that they're efficient and effective late in games. And defensively, you know, so many pick and rolls in this game, you know, getting into your defender, trying to get over the screens, being engaged and locked in off the ball as well.
It surprised you that George Karl came out and took the shots that he did at Damian, just seemingly kind of out of nowhere?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit surprising just because, you know, to my knowledge, he doesn't have a relationship with Dame, doesn't know him, has never really been around him. So for him to, you know, try to gauge his character and assassinate, you know, what he means to this team was very interesting. But obviously that's on and that's done with now, and we're just moving forward and trying to win games.
You won the most improved player last year, and you're improved even more this year, 23-something points per game. Your numbers have ticked up across the board. How important was it to you to not just be the guy that sort of sat in his laurels there with the new contract? How important was it to you to go out, whether it's the offseason, preseason, wherever, and continue to get better?
That was very important to me. Money doesn't define who I am as a person. It doesn't define my work ethic. And I just want to continue to get better each year. I think players should get better, especially when you go through your first full season of playing, you know, starter minutes in the NBA. I knew naturally that the game would slow down a little bit more for me. I'd continue to watch film, and I would step it up another notch in the summertime with my work ethic, with the preparation, figuring out where I'm going to get shots from, and kind of settling in. I think I've done that, getting better, and just got to continue to work on all aspects and all areas of my game and not get comfortable. And that's what our staff works on, just not getting comfortable and continue to have that shark mentality and that lion mindset to where you want to be a killer.
Is there an area of the game that you look at and say, this time last year, you're much better at this than you were then?
I think my pace has gotten a lot better. Decision-making, you know, on the ball with the pick and roll stuff, you know, balance on when to shoot, when to pass, and just trying to get to the free throw line more. I don't get a lot of free throw attempts. I think last year was, you know, averaging, you know, two and a half free throw attempts a game. I think I was the first person in NBA history averaging over 20 points in less than three free throw attempts. So just trying to get to the line more and put the onus and the pressure on the defense.
You must have done something cool with that new contract, right? Something with that money.
I'm on the books for $3.2 million this year. So for people,
Man, you can't tell me I'm only on the books for $3.2 million. Okay, you can't give me that.
I'm just saying, as opposed to what they see, you know, they see I signed for $106 million. They think I automatically got some money. It's like my lifestyle hasn't changed. I live in the same house. I wear the same clothes. I might have bought a few more suits, but you know, besides, you know, purchasing my mom a house, I haven't bought myself anything. My lifestyle has not changed. I drive a Chevy Tahoe. from McLaughlin Chevy. People can say I changed all they want, but I really haven't. You know me, you know that I haven't.
Well, CJ, congratulations on the individual success. And I know you guys are working hard to turn things around out there in Portland with more than half the season, of course, still to go. Thanks for taking some time to join us here on the podcast.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me on.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks and CJ McCollum for joining the show. A reminder, you can listen to archive podcasts at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, leave a comment, post a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.